options. And don't forget to sprinkle some oregano on your pizza.
This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. Oh, my mic is like either not on or quiet or dead. Ah, okay. I see. If I speak like right up into it, it sort of works. You know what? I'm going to try a different mic. So much for the panache, right? You can tell that this isn't one of those slightly slicker programs engineered by Michael Haskins, who is among the best of us, and he has a job at BAI that I really admire. Okay, is this working at all? One, two, aha, there we go. There's a working microphone. Sigh, good. Okay. Good morning. Yeah, this is live radio. That doesn't mean that we're not going to ask you for money. We are. That number, everything that Michael was saying, everything that Noel was saying, you know, all everything you've been hearing for lo, the, you know, since the beginning of October and through next week is all true. And so far, this fundraising drive uncharacteristically is going fairly well. This is, however, my first time on during this drive. I may or may not be here next week. Part of that will depend on, whether you pledge this morning. And I hope you will, because I'm going to primarily do a show. What show is that? I should say. My name is Jim Freund. The program is called Hour of the Wolf, and it's a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. And this program was founded in 1972 by Margot Adler. And we're going to be hearing a lot from Margot during this next half hour. And Samhain, or All Hallows' Eve, or All Hallows' Day, more to the point, is the time when, in paganism, people believe that the veil between the world of our ancestors and our current world, that the veil is thinner, and that we are able to communicate with those people. And so I am, it's obviously a good time of year for me and perhaps some other BAI people and certainly a lot of NPR folk and all that to be thinking of Adler, who was such an amazing force. We'll talk about that a little later, but this will be our annual Samhain show. And when I had more airtime than is currently allotted to me, I used to be able to fill easily 3 hours of material, including a short story and various musics. And there are any number of ways one can go with Halloween or Samhain. You can be scary. You can do the ghost stories. You can. It's a time when the world of fairy is very active. And so you can do high fantasy. You can tell stories of healing, because it is so important, one of the four major holidays of the pagan year, and so forth. I have decided to do a musical tribute to many of these, but actually leaning more towards the more modern view of Halloween and all that. And so, are there any Halloween songs that refer to Hour of the Wolf? Well, Hour of the Wolf, of course, was a movie directed by Ingmar Bergman. And he explains that Vargtimen, or Hour of the Wolf, is an old belief held by the Romans that the morning twilight, the time between night and dawn, the rising of the sun, which one may point out in places like Sweden, where the movie was made, the morning twilight, you know, it's 2 to 3 hours long. So this is not a short, brief period of time. The Hour of the Wolf could very well be 3 hours. Sometimes it could be 30 minutes. In New York, it was more like 5 minutes or so. But it usually fell between 5 and 7 a.m., the time that this radio program was in, the time slot this show was in for 39 years. Until 5 years, almost exactly 5 years ago. So the Hour of the Wolf is misinterpreted by many people, largely because it was the concept of it was ill-informed in a popular TV series called Babylon 5. What is her name? The lead character played by Claudia Christian. Ivanova? Something like that. At any rate, she muses in an episode called Hour of the Wolf, that the Hour of the Wolf is, you know, that time, that it was at 3 a.m. I'm sorry, that's incorrect. Hour of the Wolf is the morning twilight. You can look it up. It's something that's been around for 1,000 years, easily. No, more. It's the ancient Romans. So more like 2,000 years. And, well, suffice it to say, I'm dealing with a computer that is online. The computer that is online in this room does not act like the computer that we normally use for broadcasting. But I'm pulling some musics and things off of the internet, legally, I may add. And I'm doing mixes, so I don't want to screw it up. So is there a song that refers to Hour of the Wolf? Yes, there is. Leave it to Danny Elfman. That is, if the player will play. Let's give that another try, shall we? Okay. Human error. Let's try that again. Oh, yeah. I started with the wrong song. I started with Dead Man's Party, which is a wonderful song, but it's also almost, well, 6.5 minutes long, and it was No One Lives Forever, where they do the line, "Let's have a party, there's a full moon in the sky. It's the Hour of the Wolf, and I don't want to die." This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And it's only listener-sponsored if you help sponsor us. $25 a year will make you a full subscriber to WBAI. You can vote in the board elections. We just finished a round, and there'll be another in a year. It's very important to participate in the process that makes this place run. And it's even more important to make sure that we do run. There are nefarious forces aligned against this radio station. I'm sure you've heard about it on the other shows. And the only thing I will say is to quote that great philosopher, Walt Kelly, "We have met the enemy, and it is us." But it's not here. It's not when you call to pledge to WBAI. It's, well, that's the friend. That's not the enemy at all in any way, shape, or form. The telephone number to call and pledge. I ask about becoming a BAI buddy. That's $10 a month. Or just become a subscriber for $25. Already a subscriber? Give a gift subscription to somebody you like. Give it to somebody you hate. Give it to somebody you know, just feel bleh about. Just say meh. Get subscribe to the station. 516-620-3602. And let's see. Okay. I was talking about Adler before, and I'm going to do that now. Margot Adler, as mentioned, started this program in 1972, 5 to 7 a.m., 5 days a week. It was the show that turned WBAI into a 24-hour-a-day outlet. Before that, we would sign off, somewhere after 3 a.m., either Bob Fass or Steve Post would turn off the transmitter if the people around the building allowed them. Now, Fass, okay, he loved to stay on and on and on. No reason not to. And he did so. In fact, frequently when Hour of the Wolf was on and I was there at 5, Bob was still in here. You know, he left maybe, 5:15, 5:30. That was fine. You know, 5 a.m., you're not going to, like, battle it out for whose microphone is it anyway. Lister and I. Lister just came in. We have that same kind of arrangement. But I'm a little stricter about it nowadays for a pragmatic reason. It's not to do with broadcasting or airtime. It's got to do with podcasting. The fact that our archive, which is made available as a podcast and on demand, starts as determined by computer. Computer doesn't understand, oh, they're letting the air flow. Computer says 1:30, 2, 3 a.m. You know, and that's it. That's Hour of the Wolf. So if Lister graciously says, oh, don't worry, you can, you know, run over 5-10 minutes or whatever, which he's frequently done, that's fine. But then if somebody's listening to the archive or the podcast, they don't get that. They don't get to hear it. It's cut off at 3 a.m. no matter what. They play no favorites. So that's that. Anyway, getting back to Adler. Margot was an amazing person. I will probably never tell the story on the air of how we met for the very first time, which is something that we figured out years later. And we had to each go to our parents to assert that was true. I will tell you that I was not yet 1 year old and that Margot was about 7. And she had an opportunity to not babysit, because all the parents were, at least both fathers, were available at that time. Margot's father was the eminent psychiatrist, Dr. Kurt Adler. Her grandfather was Alfred Adler, as in Freud, Adler, and Young. Whereas there was a guy named Bill Young at the radio station. I rearranged the mailboxes at the station. So it was Freund, Adler, and Young. Not Jung, but Young. Okay, hey. Close enough for radio, as we like to say. So anyway, but Margot was legit. She is the granddaughter of Alfred Adler, who collaborated with Freud until they had a falling out over the Oedipus complex, something that Adler did not subscribe to and Freud wanted to base all of his theories on. And at that point, there was a rift between them. Okay, so Margot was that. Margot was in the free speech movement at Berkeley and a member of the second of the Veni Saramos Brigade in 1963. Yeah, Lister knows what that is. 1963 was the second. I think the first was 62. And then in 63, a bunch of journalists went to Canada and got an airplane and went to Havana. This is, when did the blockade to Cuba begin? About 58, 59? Something in there, right. So Margot was one of the first American journalists in Cuba. She went with a group of like 10 people, I think. And there were another 10 that forged the way first. So Margot was in the second wave. Still pretty damn good, I dare say. There were many Veni Saramos brigades years later. It kept going. I think there was one as recently as 5 years ago. Ironically, or to show you how things have changed, a friend of mine from São Paulo, Brazil, was trying to chart her airfare. She was trying to buy an inexpensive ticket. And leaving from Kennedy Airport, isn't it ironic that it's, JFK, the plane goes where? The layover was in Havana. From JFK to Havana, not the first time Kennedy had that idea, I guess. Even after he's gone, he's still trying to land in Havana. Anyway, it seems appropriate, doesn't it, Lister? Yeah, really. So it's like, doing another change, a welcome change in the world. So, let's see, Margot became, she was at the Berkeley, she was in California, then she moved back to New York, where she's from, attended Columbia University at the journalism, of course, and took a job at WBAI. She'd already been volunteering at KPFA, took a job at BAI as the weekend news director, and was on staff doing that. In 1972, she made a deal with the station manager, when that was a little bit illegal, but neither of them are around, so the story may be told. She told the story in the air many times anyway, where she agreed that he could fire her so she could get unemployment and she would continue to do the news under the condition that she get her own late night show. Liza Cowan had paved the way for, it was an all-boys club, right? It was Fast, Post, Gorman, Julius Lester, and somebody else. It was a fifth guy. And then Liza Cowan did Electra Rewired, and then eventually Hour of the Wolf broke into that, broke that line, broke the all-boys club, and was turned the station into a 24-hour station from 5 to 7 a.m. We no longer signed off. Fast had to go to 5 a.m. Post had to go to 5 a.m. And Larry Josephson, who would come on at 7 a.m., didn't have the joy that he had once had of turning on the transmitter. He got over it, but it was still a little bit jarring, these big sea changes. You know, what do we have to be on the air 24 hours a day for? Well, we just are. Today it would be unthinkable to do anything different. But it was Adler who changed that. What other major marks and contributions did she do? Well, yeah, she was at BAI for many a year, and then became one of the first people to work for the newly founded NPR, and one of the first correspondents on All Things Considered and Morning Edition and the other shows. She was sometimes host of All Things Considered. These are not minor things. Oh, and somewhere in there, I went, there was, the station was on 62nd, just off of First Avenue, in an old church. We call it the church. And on 59th Street, there was a witches and Satanists supply store. And they had a speaker named Witch Wally, W-A-L-L-I, who I later found out was like associated with Mick Jagger and all these wealthy celebrities, where she would do tarot readings for them and things like that. And I said to Adler, let's go. This sounds like fun. And they're like, oh, yes. And Adler and I went, and she sort of spiritually stayed, where I, you know, went back to the station. Margot became a Wiccan, and eventually in 1979 published a book entitled Drawing Down the Moon, which has never been out of print since. It has introduced literally hundreds of thousands of Americans to the already somewhat established in England tradition of Wicca, witchcraft. And Margot became a high priest, and something that was not discussed on the air during her lifetime was queened. That is to say, she was anointed by the craft community to be the queen of witches for North America. So, you know, and Wicca has become an accepted and legal religion. In 1979, Adler performed wedding ceremonies, including one for me. I mean, the marriage didn't take, but the ceremony was wonderful. Anyhow, I'm with my current partner now for 28 years or something like that. I'm very happy. So, but that was a great wedding. Hand fasting. Actually, it was a hand fasting. So, you know, head of a religion. One of the first reporters in Cuba. The person who turned BAI into a 24-hour-a-day radio station and, in many ways, my soulmate. She was my, you know, everybody wants a role model. She was mine. She started Hour of the Wolf, and Thursdays and Fridays were the science fiction mornings on which I was her co-host. I was generally her engineer otherwise, but I was her co-host for Thursdays and Fridays. Very often, either Neil Conan or Mike Hodel were her co-hosts on Mondays. She had sort of a repertory going there. Tuesdays and Wednesdays were her. Thursdays and Fridays were me. But always Margo. She was always there. Until 1973, during the summer, she went off to the Clarion Science Fiction Workshop. And when she came back, she took a different time slot, which is how I became host of Hour of the Wolf. Why am I talking so much about her? Well, Samhain is coming up. She died about 2.5 years ago of a uterine cancer. And I'm, you know, it's shaken a great many people up, myself included. There are many, many people in the world who could claim to be soulmates with Adler. And each one of us is right. Each one of us has a greater claim than anybody else. And Samhain, memorial service was held on Samhain, which on the one hand was appropriate, on the other hand disappointed a lot of Wiccans who wanted to be at her memorial. And let me tell you, the other witches of the world are busy on Halloween. They've got their own covens, their own groups to attend to on those days. So, so mote it be. But it was a decision made by her son, Alex, and, you know, it was a righteous one. And I decided that the reading series that I run, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, would create a pop-up series, one that will happen whenever I say it will, called the Margot Adler Memorial Readings. Aha! Now we see Freund's plan over WBAI in New York. Had to sneak in the station break somehow. This coming Tuesday, Samhain, All Souls Day, All Hallows Day, not All Souls Day, All Saints Day. The day after All Saints Day is All Souls Day. But that's, you know, like a Christian thing. We're dealing with pagans here. Samhain. All Hallows Day, the evening of which people know better as Halloween, All Hallows Eve. But Tuesday is All Hallows Day. We will have the first of the Margot Adler Memorial Readings here at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free. Donations are highly suggested. And our readers will be journalist Sabrina Vervulius, and a fine, fine science fiction writer she is. Speculative fiction. Let's not box her in. And Terrence Taylor, who's been an often guest on this program and is our technical director for the readings and also author of two vampire novels, which Margot rated. In fact, Margot rated almost 300 vampire novels. She wrote capsule reviews, and you can find that online at npr.org. The only book that she read in between all these other things were American Gods by Neil Gaiman. I'm sorry she won't get to see the TV series, but she had this belief, almost this hang-up, about vampires in her later years. John, her husband, had gotten cancer, a horrible cancer, stomach cancer. And Margot started thinking, well, what is it like? She'd never even read Dracula. She'd never read a vampire book in her life. So what would it be to basically sell your soul in exchange for eternal life? What would you give to have your loved one with you? Vampires is the fictional, philosophical answer to that. That's where a lot of vampire fiction comes from. Certainly the way Margot took it. And so her third book, her first book was Drawing Down the Moon. Second was called Heretic's Heart, which includes a chapter about doing Hour of the Wolf in there, which is, by the way, on my website. If you want to read that chapter, it's at ourwolf.com. How appropriate. And the third book was Vampires Are Us. And she explained about vampires, and you're going to hear that explanation very shortly. But before I play that, which is a talk that she gave at, not a Unitarian church, it's more encompassing. Unitarians are usually of different Christian beliefs, but this one also takes in Jews, Muslims, agnostics, people who wanted to hear about any kind of faith. Sort of like the Ethical Culture Society, but a bit more religious than that. So it was there that she gave a lecture about vampires. And she also did, by the way, at one of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. She was often often four times. She was the host, guest host, and curator of several of the readings. And they were all about vampires. So that's the point of the Margot Adler reading series. They will cover vampires, journalism, radio, psychiatry, so many of the things that Adler touched. Oh, and as a Clarion science fiction fantasy writer graduate, anything science fiction and fantasy pertains. She never did get around to writing any science fiction or fantasy. And I asked her why, as she and I were coming back March of 2 years ago from LunaCon, the New York a regional science fiction convention, and we were driving her back home. It's just in Westchester. It's like, you know, half an hour drive. And I asked, why didn't you ever write science fiction or fantasy? And she said, well, I was on such a quest for the truth that I never had the time to put down fiction. Well, Margot, I disagree with you. I still disagree. You look into fiction and you find truth. Science fiction is about the present. It's not about the future. And alternate worlds are about our worlds. It's the alien viewpoint of who we are. There are all these things. So, but that's an argument that I would give a lot to have with her. At any rate, here she is at one of her All Souls sermons discussing vampires. Ah, but before that, let me remind you, you got to pay for your supper. The telephone number is 516-620-6302. Or go to give2wbai.org. Give2wbai.org. Say that in your sleep. Memorize it, remember it. And then when you get there, you click down, there's a drop-down box, you know, and you give a tribute to the show. That show is mine! It was Margot's, but now it's mine. It's Hour of the Wolf. But just give to the station, please. $25. Become a subscriber. Become a BAI buddy for $10 a month. Or up the ante. $60, you get a t-shirt, a mug, a little something. I don't think we have tote bags. Actually, we do, don't we? I think we do, yeah. All that stuff. They're actually a nice design. So, last time for now, 516-620-3602 or give to WBAI.org. Now, set your Wayback Machine to, about 6 years ago, and let's listen a little bit to Margot. No. We heard that already. Wrong button, Jim. Well, right button, but wrong thing that was queued up. Let me bring down the volume on that player and force feed. There we are. Are we set? Yes, we are set. Good. It's actually going to run this time. Let me bring the volume back up. Good, Jim. Good boy, Jim. Okay. You wouldn't believe I was chief announcer here at one time. Okay. And let's try that again.
I was never interested in vampires. If you asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, "Are you kidding?" I'd read maybe one vampire novel, not the 250 I have read now. I had seen one movie, The Hunger, probably because I knew the author. But going to a conference, I bought some trashy novels for the plane. I read the two Twilight novels, and it might have ended right there. But 8 days later, my husband was diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer. I started obsessing on vampire novels, sitting by his bedside while he slept, because I was thinking about mortality. My husband and partner of 33 years was dying, and he was someone who wanted to live forever. There was a definite tension between our views on death. A tension I didn't really understand until after he died. It's also a tension I realize now that exists in many of the most interesting vampire novels. My husband had what I would call the high-tech view of death. It was to be avoided at all costs. He was a runner, he was in perfect health, he took various supplements and antioxidants, he drank a glass of wine for resveratrol, he never smoked, he was fit, and unlike me, he never did any drugs in his youth. He thought he would live to be 100 or preferably even older, and a science journalist, he followed scientific discoveries and all the advances of aging research. And when he did die, he thought he might have his ashes flown up in space. His attitude was definitely rage, rage, rage against the dying of the light. I, at that same moment, had more of an earth-centered pagan perspective. We're all part of the life cycle, like a seed. We are born, we sprout, we grow, we mature, we decay, we make room for future generations who, like seedlings, are reborn through us. As for the persistence of consciousness, deep down I thought, how can we know? Perhaps we simply return to the elements. We become earth and air and fire and water. That seemed okay to me. In fact, I remember reading in a book by the feminist author Barbara Walker that the ancient meaning of the four elements was the way we went to die. We were left for carrion in the air, we were buried in the earth, we were burned on the pyre, and we were buried in the depths of the sea. That also seemed all right. Although deep down, there was a part of me that was on my husband's wavelength and wanted to live forever. The vampire of myth and literature embodies some of that same tension my husband and I had regarding death. They have near immortality and yet are tragically frozen in time. They cannot grow and change like the seasons or, in most descriptions, birth new life. And yet they have superpowers and strength and often the wisdom that can come with extreme age, an often cynical, jaundiced view of life. Rosalie, who bemoans her frozen state in the Twilight novels, is asking the same question asked in books like Tuck Everlasting or Olaf Stapleton's famous science fiction novel from 1930, Last and First Men. Humans want to be part of nature, yet we still want to push the edge of the envelope, seeking to be more. Vampires let us play with death and the issue of mortality. They let us ponder what it would mean to be truly long-lived. They allow us to ask questions we usually bury except in science fiction. What does one value more and what does one value less with a short human life? Is the vampire's frozen life sterile? Does life only mean something when it's part of a cycle of birth, growth, decay, death, and the birth of new life? Is there a beauty that comes only from the cycles of the season which we are a part? So in the beginning, I pondered mortality, But I knew it didn't explain the millions of readers and movie viewers and television watchers who were devouring vampire stories. An article in The Hollywood Reporter a year or so ago said, vampires brought in $7 billion to the Hollywood economy in the last 2 years, the GDP of a small nation. 117 million Twilight books have been sold the last time I looked. And this is not just a teen phenomena. There are at least 30,000 adult women on a Twilight Moms website. New vampire novels continue to be constant bestsellers for adults and teens. And on television, there's The Vampire Diaries, True Blood, and both the American and British versions of Being Human. On a recent trip to Europe, I found that my Dutch teenage relatives in Amsterdam and the 20-year-olds at a conference I spoke to at Edinburgh were absolutely obsessed with The Vampire Diaries. I wanted to understand why vampires have such pull, such popularity, such traction in our culture, both in American and much European culture at this very moment in time. It's very easy to dismiss all this pop culture snidely and to say, for example, oh, it's all about teens and sex or even repressed sex. You've read the articles, how Twilight is all about abstinence from a Mormon point of view and Edward's a stalker. I don't believe it for a minute. We all now know that rape is not about sex. It's about power. I began to wonder if maybe the interest in vampires was really a meditation on power and its abuses. One of the reasons that vampires are interesting is that they, like we, are in conflict over issues of power. We want it, we distrust it, we get twisted by it, we abuse it, we love it, we hate it, we struggle with it. Almost every recent vampire novel, film, and television show confronts this issue. Amy Smith, a Quaker who teaches courses on the literature of war and also on vampire films and fiction at the University of the Pacific, puts it this way. The central question in so many of these films and novels is, if you had power over others, how would you use it? The tension is always between, we're at the top of the food chain, we can do what we want, humans are cattle, they're prey, versus, we were once human. How can we treat humans like cattle? This is the same tension, she says, that we have in life. If you earn more money than someone, if you have more power than someone, how will you use it? Does having more power or status give you the right to use it? Does might make right? It's really the same question, she says. Teens who naturally feel invisible and powerless, since they are still under the thumb of the twin authorities of school and parents, find the fantasy of difference, of special powers and abilities, intoxicating. Whether these powerful creatures are the X-Men, the beings of Pandora, or vampires, they identify with the struggle of wanting power, yet they often see its dangers with clearer eyes than their parents, because they are watching from the outside as the older generation abuses power, often wielding it over them, often seeing their rites of passage as criminal. In an extraordinary email I received from Anne Rice, the author who has sold millions of vampire novels, she said, the vampire, the symbol of the outsider in all of us, is romanticized by teens because they so desperately need to find a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. Hear that again. They so desperately need to find a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. Reading that, I thought of the horrors of consumer culture they must navigate. I thought about high school. Think of the Cullens in Twilight doing high school over and over. Think about doing the senior prom 5 times. Now that's a horror story. And if we look at Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, it's all about power, women, power, and leadership. In the last season of Buffy, she's forced to renounce patriarchal power and give up her own power for the power of all women. There are hundreds of scholarly articles just about this. And of course, if we look further back, Voltaire, Engels, Marx, the people of Occupy Wall Street, all use the word vampire to describe issues of power, usually using the word for the powerful, the corrupt, the capitalist, the Wall Street trader. Most of the teen vampire stories are not only about power, they're really about choice and identity. Bella, at the end of the third Twilight movie, describes herself as an outsider who feels more at home in an inhuman world than a human one. "This is not about you," she says to Edward. "This is about me and my choices." But that still doesn't explain what's really going on now. Every age gets the vampire it needs, feminist author Nina Auerbach wrote in her book, Our Vampires Ourselves. Every age uses vampires to express their fears and concerns, writes Eric Newsom in his book, The Dead Travel Fast. In 1897, when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, England had the largest ports in the world. There was fear of incoming disease, of foreigners, of immigration, and Stoker created the perfect monster, Eastern European, bringing dirt from a foreign land. You can do this for every period that has had a wave of interest in vampires. In the 1980s, with AIDS, for example, vampires were often described as parasites. You became infected by vampirism, like a disease. And the first vampire novel, story rather, in the English language, was started in 1816 in the same chalet on the same weekend that Mary Shelley started to write Frankenstein. The fear at that time was science replacing God. So what's happening now? Who are the vampires we have created? And what are the fears and concerns they are expressing? Look at our modern vampires, most of those of the last 15 years. The Cullens in Twilight, Bill Compton and Eric Northman in True Blood, Mick St. John in that wonderful CBS one-season series Moonlight, Mitchell, the vampire in the BBC series Being Human, Henry Fitzroy in Blood Ties by Tanya Huff, Stefan and Damon in the television show The Vampire Diaries, and let's not forget Angel and Spike in Buffy. They all have something in common that makes them different than most vampires that went before. When I put their names in a line on a piece of paper, it was like a light bulb suddenly went off. Unlike the vampires that went before, they're all struggling desperately to be moral, despite being predators. Often failing, sometimes succeeding, but all engaged in a profound struggle to lead a moral life despite their
My heartfelt apologies. I was queuing up another thing, and there's like only one media player on here. So I will try to bring us back to where Margot was, and so we can hear the end of Why We Love Vampires, her All Souls sermon.
Vampires, and let's not forget Angel and Spike and Buffy. They all have something in common that makes them different than most vampires that went before. When I put their names in a line on a piece of paper, it was like a light bulb suddenly went off. Unlike the vampires that went before, they're all struggling desperately to be moral, despite being predators. Often failing, sometimes succeeding, but all engaged in a profound struggle to lead a moral life despite their need for blood. There's a wonderful scene in the presidential vampire thriller Blood Oath by Christopher Farnsworth, which came out a couple years ago. The idea is that President Andrew Johnson found a vampire on a ship and imprisoned him. He managed to get Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans, to bind him by a blood oath to serve every president of the United States. Nathaniel Cade, the vampire, is now in the modern world serving a president somewhat like Obama. In one scene, he stands in the back of an AA meeting. He does this pretty regularly because he sees himself as an addict. And while he only drinks animal blood, he still lusts for the blood of humans. We humans are addicts, not only in the obvious ways, abusing alcohol and cigarettes and drugs and food. We are clearly in a struggle with an addictive lifestyle. 8 U.S. presidents in a row have claimed they would bring about the end of our dependence on foreign oil, and they've meant it, just like a smoker means it when he insists he will quit. But our jobs, the economy, the way we live and commute, the way our infrastructure is set up, all compromise us. We depend, at least for now, on continuing an addictive relationship to fossil fuels. Oil is our blood, and our addiction compromises the earth. Vampires are exactly us right now, as we wage wars, use oil, and suck the lifeblood out of the planet. Whitley Strieber, author of The Hunger, goes even further. He says, our prey is the planet. If so, vampires are us, and the issue before us is how we can learn to use our formidable powers without destroying the world and future generations. Like vampires, we are in a struggle with our own predation. You may ask, when did we create this vampire that represents this moral struggle? At first I thought it was Buffy, and then I thought it went back to Anne Rice. But it really goes back 45 years to Dark Shadows and the vampire Barnabas. Dark Shadows started in 1966, but Barnabas didn't appear until well into 67, and the word vampire was never used until 68, and so I started thinking about those years. In 1966, Stuart Brand, the man who founded the Whole Earth Catalog, one of the most significant environmental journals, took an LSD trip on the rooftop of a San Francisco building. He was meditating on something Buckminster Fuller had once said, that the root of man's misbehavior was the notion that our Earth was flat and infinite. On LSD, he suddenly felt and saw the curve of the Earth. When he came down, he printed up a political button and sent a couple hundred all over the world, to NASA, to Soviet and US diplomats, to members of the United Nations and members of Congress. The button had this sentence: why have we not yet seen a picture of the whole Earth? While there were a couple of fuzzy views from satellites, it would take Apollo 8 in 1968 to give us that color picture of the Earth rising. And 4 years later, another Apollo gave us the picture of the blue marble Earth, which may well be the most reproduced photograph in history. Those photographs changed us. At first we saw just no boundaries, and we are all brothers and sisters, but eventually we understood the darker vision. We saw our vulnerabilities for the first time. We saw ourselves as compromised morally, standing on this fragile planet and not doing what we need to do to save her. 1970 was the first Earth Day, the real beginning of the environmental movement, as we suddenly saw the Earth's fragility, a tiny ball of brilliant color in a dark universe, a ball so small the astronauts could blot it out with their thumb. They all noted it, and we all changed. Our vampires changed at the same moment. This image changed us and our thinking. I think the vampires so many are identifying with allow us to look at ourselves more clearly, to see the compromises we make daily, the moral struggles we often lose or more commonly deny. Sylvia Plath wrote, "I'm terrified of this dark thing that lives in me." And Stephen Moore in The Vampire in Verse writes, "The reason you can't see a vampire in the mirror, the vampire is a mirror, reflecting our secret self." Hopefully these morally conflicted vampires will allow us not only to see our abuses of power more clearly, but give us a few insights on how we can struggle to live more morally on this earth. And now, when someone says to me, "How could you waste 3 years reading vampire novels?" I paraphrase something that the late great science fiction writer Philip K. Dick once said, that when the divine is exiled from much of our culture, sometimes you have to look for it in the trash. Blessed be.
Okay, I mean, what can we say? That was Adler. That is who she was. That kind of a thinker. That kind of a fascinating, provocative, evocative person. And I miss her, but we will have her on recording and in many ways. Look around. You will see her commemorated many places, many ways, by many things. And on Tuesday, starting this coming Tuesday, on All Souls, All Saints Day, or if you prefer All Hallows Day, or if you prefer Samhain, we will have the first of our Margot Adler Memorial readings as part of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Is that a mouthful? And our readers will be Terrence Taylor and Sabrina Vervulias. And I hope you will join us. It's here at 388 Atlantic Avenue. It starts at 7 p.m. Good idea to show up about 6:30. Again, admission free, donations highly desired. I have to pay rent and stuff. I neglected at the top of the show, because I was dealing with so many different things in my head at one time, and I think that my head was up a different orifice of my body at that moment, I neglected to play our movie review. So we're going to do that in a moment. Dan Persons is with us on recording. And after that, we will play some of our appropriate music for the season until Burn Baby Burn Clapper comes on the air at about 3 a.m. So, again, the phone number to call and pledge your support is 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. Pledge $25 to keep WBAI solvent and alive and keep not the kind of wolf that we have on Hour of the Wolf, but the other wolves from the door. They're Californian, may I add. Okay, so here then. is Dan's review.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There aren't really any parallels between the Japanese animated film Miss Hokusai and the American animated film Tower, but I'm going to make them anyway because I want to make a point about the medium. Both are based on history. Hokusai, about an iconoclastic daughter of a legendary and equally iconoclastic 19th century artist. Tower, about the 1966 Texas clock tower shootings that ushered in a new age of serial murder. There's always the question of why, outside of budget, animation is being used to recreate historic events. In the case of Hokusai, at least the artists at the excellent animation studio Production IG frequently take imaginative flight in their telling, such as showing the spirit of a dragon manifesting as Oi Katsushika, daughter and assistant to the legendary artist Hokusai, struggles to create the beast on paper, or a moment when the soul of a courtesan frees itself from her body to fly around a room. Tower, by comparison, takes a more grounded approach, basing its animation on what appears to be rotoscoped live footage. So why go animation at all? Just by coincidence, both films indulge in the same interesting technique at key moments. In the case of Tower, it revolves around the first victim of the clock tower sniper, a pregnant woman who's shot along with her fiancé. In Hokusai, it's when Oi's father goes to visit his blind and gravely ill younger daughter after a long estrangement. In both cases, the filmmakers conspire to drop away the background, stranding the characters in blank voids. The goals for each film are different. In Tower, the technique is used whenever we return to the woman, emphasizing her isolation. In Hokusai, it underlines the importance of this moment, as father becomes the world for daughter, and vice versa, while also conveying, paradoxically visually, the emotional perception of the blind girl. You could replicate this technique in live action, but not as effectively as when rendered under the animator's pencil. In that way and more, both films are able to justify their medium. Miss Hokusai is a vivid examination of the place of artists within a Japan evolving out of the age of the samurai. Tower is a harrowing document of the lives that were upended by a hitherto unimagined act of violence. told in first-person recollections and employing the stylization of animation to bring a primal immediacy to the experience. Both films are running now. They're both worth seeing. And I want to make a note of a few re-releases coming to home video. If you've never seen Cat People, and if you haven't, what's wrong with you? But if you haven't seen the original Cat People, Criterion has just released an excellent restoration on Blu-ray. One of my favorite horror moments of all time is the pool sequence from this film, just a perfect use of light and sound. The terror is all suggestion, a specialty of producer Val Lewton, but no less real. There's also plenty of atmosphere and suggestion in the original Japanese version of Dark Water, which is getting a re-release now and is a wonderful example of J-horror, marvelously creepy in its story of a single mother moving in with her young daughter into an apartment building haunted by a tragic secret. It builds beautifully and has some visually spectacular moments, and again, if you've never seen real J-horror, not the American remakes. This particular film was remade with Jennifer Connelly. Dark Water would be an excellent place to start. I'm Dan Persons. Presume nothing. Polls are nice, but they mean nothing if you don't actually go out and vote. Take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed, and let's defeat Trump.
Get you. bad, I feel bad. Last night, a hoot-owl come and sit right over my door. Last night, a hoot-owl come and sit right over.
She showed me a shirt of the softest silk, well wrought with pearls about the band. Sighed, if you will be my lover so true, this goodly gift you shall command. Alison Gross, she must be the ugliest witch in the North Country. Alison Gross, she must be the ugliest witch in
the ugly.
loveliest bridge in the North Country. She's turned her body to roundabout, and thrice she blew on a grass green horn. She swore by the moon and the stars up above that she'd make me rue the day I was born. Then out she has taken a silver wand. She's turned her three times round and round. She's muttered such words to my strength it did fail, and she's turned me into an ugly worm. Addison Gross, she must be the ugliest witch in the North Country. Addison Gross, she must be the ugliest witch in the North Country.
Myself shall bear the blame. came you here to dwell? The queen of fairies caught me when from my horse I fell.
There was Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Steel Eye Span, of course, with Alison Gross, and then Tamlin by Fairport Convention with Sandy Denny. And I've got, three more hours of appropriate music for Halloween, but let that get you started. And join us, as I said, on Samhain at 388 Atlantic Avenue at 7 p.m. That's this Tuesday. Samhain is on Tuesday, otherwise known as All Saints Day or All Hallows Day, for Terrence Taylor and Sabrina Vervulius reading at the first Margot Adler Memorial Reading Series. A good time to be had. We will share some rosemary for remembrance. And or you can bring your own. That'll be nice. It's not just a Shakespearean quote. It is a pagan ritual to pass around rosemary. And we could do the whole ritual at the reading, but I you know, it's not exactly the right place for it. So we will make mention. I will give a little talk at the beginning, and then Terrence will be hosting. He's the guest curator. And Sabrina Vervilius, a fine journalist, excellent speculative fiction writer, will be joining us. I have been told by at least one listener that the pledge line that I have been pitching so hard for ain't working. It ain't doing its job. And so just nobody answering. I'm sure this is not the first time that complaint has come up. So I suggest if you would like to pledge during this show, either try the website at WBAI.org. You could do the give to WBAI, numeral 2, but try just WBAI.org and follow the links and then, you know, pull down for, you know, the show that you're pledging during, and that would be Hour of the Wolf. And thank you all for listening. Our time is up, and here's a little more Steel I Span, my usual outro to go out with. I often use Thomas the Rhymer in October, but this will do. This is Sails of Silver, and it befits the season. Good Samhain to you all, blessed be. And I don't know if I'm going to be on next week or not. It's still fundraising. And while I do a certain amount of programming, we also hope that we're going to raise money at the same time because it's called survival. Another thing you can do, if you come to the Margot Adler reading on Tuesday, I'll give you a pledge blank. You can pledge then and there. Ha ha. Unless you're in Canada, I don't know what to do about that. Actually, come to think of it, I can mail a pledge form to that person who's been having these problems. Again, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Lister with Burn Baby Burn Clapper over these same airwaves. Take good care of yourself and others. Good morning.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. The red, white, and the blue who spit on you.
Myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it bits cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Number one.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it. Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on
piece of cloth. That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Station WBAI 99.5 FM Lister. last straw. Papa Moses back on the radio right here. At exactly 11 minutes after 3 o'clock, burn, baby, burn, where we burn the red, white, and blue to ashes. And you gotta keep the station alive by going to give2wbai.
It is obvious that one day.
.org.
I and you must have a showdown, a showdown. Now you're the one that's always boasting. Boasting. You better come good. Us I Rasta on the count. Let's go.
Thank you very much, Pablo Moses. Last straw. 99 Sync, the list alive right here. We need you to call up right now and pledge $50. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602, y'all.
In my father's house.
At the $50 level, two telephone calls would do this trick. We're gonna have to stop the music because we gotta get this off the ground. We gotta raise some money real quick right here. If we can get three telephone calls at the $50 level, that would get us over the hump instantly right here at 516-620-3602. That's the number, 516-620-3602. 99 Sync or WBAI, Burn Baby Burn, the only flag burning show in the entire world. And it's amazing that it's coming out of Imperialist USA. But these are political times and you got to get political or you just will die. So we got to keep this vanguard of Pacifica right here, as Errol Maitland and Don DeBar would say, by donating something. As we say at WSB, WBAI is the militant canary at the end of the tunnel. So, let's do it. We got...